books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today Tia Fisher discusses her Carnegie Medal for Writing shortlisted book, Not Going to Plan. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. But first on today's show, some news not about audiobooks, but about this very show. Here's David Hogg.
Read it!
Fantastic news, one of our RNIB Connect radio shows has been nominated for an ARIA in the Best Speech Entertainment category. The ARIAs is the UK Audio and Radio Awards presented annually to recognise, honour and reward outstanding shows and the teams behind them, judged by over 200 senior audio and radio practitioners drawn from all sectors of the industry. It is a huge accolade to be nominated. Read On, the audiobook show, is our weekly show all about audiobooks from RNIB Talking Books. It brings our listeners interviews with authors and narrators, as well as reviews, news and clips from new releases about all things bookish, centering on the spoken word and accessible reading. Other nominees in our category are Zoe Ball and Joe Wiley, Louis Theroux, Matt Chorley, Jamila Jamil and Rylan, amongst others. Robert Kirkwood delivers an incredible show each week and we are all so thrilled to get a nomination in this category. It's also great to highlight the work RNIB does in making reading accessible to blind and partly sighted people. The main ceremony is May the 21st at the Roundhouse in Camden. Hey. Here you go.
No pressure on today's ARIA nominated show then. Cue the music. Tia Fisher was last on Read On when her book Crossing the Line won the Sharrowers Award at the Carnegies in 2024. And this year she's back on the shortlist with Not Going to Plan, which is narrated by Imogen Front and Charlie Bateman.
Everybody hates me. I press myself back in the seat. Mum grips the wheel tighter. No, they don't. They do. But she won't listen, and we're nearly here. The 10-foot-high, prison-style electronic gates swing open with barely a whisper, and we're sucked inside the Death Star that is Winford Independent Highly Selective College for Girls. Our cheap little car creeps up the drive, mindful of the sign that says, "Careful of children crossing." Children? Spawn of Satan, more like. Marnie, don't mess it up, I'm begging you. Mum's voice is all flat, like it got run over. She sounded different when I was 10, when I got into Winford. Back then, she screamed with joy. You passed the entrance test! She was dancing in the kitchen, tilting the letter in her fingers so the gold crest sparkled like a party invitation. Better yet, you got the scholarship! She high-fived me. Boarding school is such a great chance, a chance to get away from here! She meant away from this particular postcode, from the smell of poverty and no hope, clinging to the walls of the bus stop like grease in a chicken shop. She had a point, but I hated Winford College all the same.
Not Going to Plan is a YA verse novel. And for me, the thing that makes it really special is that it's told in two voices. There's Zed and there's Marnie, and they're talking together. It's almost like a play. It's a duologue. And Marnie is this impetuous, artistic, rebellious 16-year-old. She gets chucked out of her very posh single-sex boarding school she's got a scholarship to, much to the horror of her mum. And she gets sent to Zed's school, the local comp. Zed's a nerd. He's also about to take his GCSEs. He's the class loner. They couldn't be more different personality types.
I saw the new girl at lunchtime, sitting on her own by the rubbish bins, both looking too contaminated to touch. I wonder if I should sit by her, but her face was unreadable, so I slipped into my customary spot, reasoning she might also need a little quiet time to recalibrate. I might not have been listening when Ms. Rahman warned me, and obviously there were no other free desks, but still it was a shock having my space invaded like that. I'm not totally inflexible, but I do prefer to be prepared. To get my balance back, I return to the number sequence that's been going up and down in my head all winter. The Collatz conjecture is a riddle. If a number is even, divide it by 2. If a number is odd, multiply it by 3 and add 1. No one has ever found a starting number where the sequence doesn't eventually finish in an endless loop of 4, 2, 1. The chance of finding a maverick digit which produces a different result is vanishingly improbable, since supercomputers have failed. But I find the pursuit both fascinating and comforting in equal measure.
It's sort of interesting how tiring it is to keep a sneer where a smile could be. Like getting into a cold sea, this day gets more uncomfortable the deeper I go. I don't know the in-jokes. Who are the untouchables which teachers to avoid? I don't know anything. When everyone cracks up laughing, I stay straight-faced.
And the story starts when Marnie goes to says comprehensive and they have to sit together, as you kind of guess. And because she's got to get her GCSEs, not only to please her mum and to make it up for her mum, but also to do what she wants to do in the future, because she's got this dream of being an artist. And he's got to get all of his GCSEs because he wants to go to Oxford to study physics and he wants to get into the super selective sixth form. And they've each got weak subjects, as you guess. You know, he's physics, and so his weak subject is languages, and she's artistic, and she can't do maths. They end up tutoring each other. And through this being thrown together, they develop this respect for each other that turns into a liking. And then Marnie has this moment. She's one of the things she loves about the comp is that there are boys there. Right? She's come from a single sex school. She goes to a party, her very first party. She gets drunk with the class misogynist, this toxic male, and he pretends to be using a condom, and he's not. And the repercussions of that throw this massive spanner into the friendship between Marnie and Zed, and is it going to wreck both their futures?
In physics with Ms. Rahman, I sit beside a big girl who stares at the shiny patch of old gum stuck on the fabric of my sleeve. She digs me with a sharp elbow. "You're wearing my old blazer," she laughs on a loud wave of cheese and onion breath. We are in the bottom set. I ask her where Zed is. "With Dr. Allinger and all the other super nerds," she says, making it sound like a bad place to be.
The doc staggers and leans heavily on the periodic table. "Zebedee Donovan," he gasps, one hand hammering his heart, the other one holding my hand in. "Only 92%. You dropped 8 marks. However, can you live with such imperfection?" He finds himself so much more amusing than we do, but I admit I'm a little perturbed until I examine the paper. It would have been 100%, but Dr. Allinger misread what I'd intended to convey. Happens all the time.
Now, Marnie, at the start you said she's been expelled. And I remember from writing questions a couple of years back, for crossing the line, that you didn't have the best time at school. Is there a part of Marnie in you?
There is 100% of Marnie is me. I actually wrote the scene where I got expelled when I was in the head teacher's study and he invited me back for sit form because I was not stupid, but I was not so stupid that I would go back. Yes, this is, I'm so close to Marnie. Her impetuousness, her inability to look forward 2 jumps is very much me. And I wrote out, yeah, we write what we know, don't we? I wanted to kind of lay the demon of my teenagerdom in Marnie.
Who was it poetry got you kicked out?
Okay, so I went to this boarding school, which wasn't posh, and it wasn't poetry that nearly got me kicked out of that school. It was the next school I went to. I don't talk about the reasons why I nearly got kicked out of that school, but they had good reason, believe me. The next school I went to, which is a school I've been back to visit twice as an author, I wrote a poem about the senior leadership team and I pinned it on the notice board. And they so knew it was me that they couldn't prove it. And my mum by that time was desperate for me to take my, they were called O-levels then, was desperate for me to take my O-levels. And she told this big fat lie that wasn't our typewriter, it was Typecon, which it clearly was. and I managed to stay at that school just long enough to do my A-levels.
Now, if you're Marnie, is there a Z?
There really is. There really is a Z. Z is my youngest, who is now at Oxford doing physics. And I wanted a foil to Marnie. I wanted somebody who was so much the opposite. And that's why the concept of Z came up. But then I realized that I had this opportunity to try to discover more about my very, very private and younger child and more about the person that they were at that stage of their lives. You know, clearly neurodivergent, but needs no fixing. And they were really kind and they let me speak to them and find out a little bit more. And they were a consultant on the book, if you like. And it's a love letter to them because they are so wonderful and so gloriously funny and they don't necessarily know it. So, yeah, it's a love letter to my Zed.
As we file past his desk, the doc looks up through lenses thick as ship's portholes and calls me back. Zeb, hold up. Some good news, he says perkily. You're through to the physics marathon. The British school's physics marathon. A series of national endurance tests for only the most elite of mathletes. The winners are invited to a physics summer school at Oxford University, the dreaming spires to which I aspire. My heart beats a little faster. Dr. Allinger says my qualifying test got the highest score the school has ever seen. Although perhaps that says more about the school than me.
Hola, says the Spanish tutor, and I wince. Wherever Señor Lewis comes from, it certainly isn't Spain. Half the group offer him an hola back, so he's about midway in the teacher popularity stakes.
Señor Lewis shuffles his seating plans like a croupier. I get dealt a good hand today. Luca Moreno flops down next to me. Hola, cariño, he says with a smile. Luca's all long, bony wrists and sharp hip bones, a shock of floppy fringe over eyes the colour of Marmite. Luca's parents are from Spain, which apparently isn't cheating. Señor Lewis uses him like a portable defibrillator, resuscitating the Spanish as it dies upon our lips.
A boy from my tutor group talks to me in Spanglish. Hola, I'm Harry. ¿Cómo estás? I say, I'm fine. I'd be finer if I wasn't choking on Lynx Africa, but he's really fit. At least in a rugby player sort of way. Short, shiny hair, solid thighs, good teeth.
Now, through the magic of editing, we'll have heard Imogen Front and Charlie Bateman reading from the book. Now, the book itself is visually enhancing. You know, it's visually exciting. The words almost tell a story as well. What were the discussions like when you were going to do an audio version of the book?
I went through the book. I kind of learned about this from when we did Crossing the Line as an audio book. I went through the book and I picked the bits where the poems didn't make sense unless you could see them on the page. And we wrote different, I wrote and my editor approved, different, slightly different versions of them so that they did the explaining for you. And the actors were so amazing. So I think so excited about that audio book. Because where you lose a little bit, because you don't see the pictures that the words are created, there are loads of shape poems in there. Where you don't see those, to kind of compensate for that, you get the relationship between the two actors who sat in the same booth at the RNIB recording studios. They sat in the same booth and they bounced off each other just the way in my head the real Marnie and Zed do. So you get the radio play that is almost book. And I think that's a good compensation.
This is kind of two questions, but I think they've got the same answer. In the book, is the white space important? And in the audiobook, are the things that aren't said important?
Absolutely. So Sarah Crotton, who is like the godmother of all verse novelists in the UK, she says that she actually only writes half the book and that her readers or her listeners make up the other half, because we do these kind of stepping stones through the emotions and our wonderful imagination fills in the rest for us. So I will suggest something and you, the reader, or you, the listener, will do all the work around that and think what it is I might be saying, or, you know, the character might be saying. So Yes, both the white space and the pauses, the suggestions, the interplay between the characters. You're interpreting it and filling in the rest.
Now, we talked a couple of years ago about Crossing the Line. That was your first published book, and it was very successful very quickly. Did you feel any pressure on this book?
Do you know what? I was writing, this is my second book published, but it's actually not the second book I wrote because the books got published in a different order. So in the autumn, I've got a prose middle grade book coming out, a historical, because I was doing an MA in writing for young people at the time that Crossing the Line came out. And this was my thesis, and I thought I wanted to do something completely, completely different. So I did. When I, honestly, it was kind of the reverse of pressure. Because Crossing the Line had done so well, I then thought, you know what? I can write a book that if I hadn't been doing so, if Crossing the Line wasn't, you know, happily embedded into people's hearts and imaginations, I bet I couldn't get this one published. So I wrote the book that I really wanted to write and thought, well, now is as good a time as any that a publishing house will actually pick it up. And that was the case. So it was kind of the reverse of pressure in a good way. Now is when I'm feeling the pressure.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
More from Tia in a moment, but first let's hear what's new in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. A Taste for Murder by Matt Baker was donated by Penguin Random House.
Left to his own devices, Casey would have spent that Sunday lazing by the pool, and death would never have cast its shadow across his day. It was the third of their four-day stay in Capri, which was supposed to be the rest and recuperate leg of their Italian tour. With the rigours of Vesuvius and Pompeii behind them, but Rome and Florence and their sites of historical interest to come. Shortly after breakfast, however, Tanya had announced she was bored and demanded a shake-up in their routine. Something, anything, she really didn't care. A walking tour of Roman ruins had been tabled, and lying on his sun lounger, Casey was still congratulating himself on having suggested they hire a scooter and hit the beaches instead, when the speedboat puttered slowly into the crystalline shallows, and the surly-looking Italian at the wheel started trying to engage the assembled tourists in turn.
For Detective Chief Inspector Joe Mottram, a summer on the island of Capri was meant to be an opportunity to reconnect with his troubled teenage daughter Angelica and his Italian in-laws after his wife Francesca's death by hit and run. But when a British tourist is found dead and a member of his late wife's family is accused of murder, Joe is pulled back into the world of police cells, crime scenes and local corruption. As he discovers more about the island, he realises it holds the answers to Francesca's death, which may not have been a tragic accident after all.
Casey had already begun to raise his hand to make the universal sign for thanks but no thanks, when Tanya put down her book and called out a query. A 5-minute standoff had ensued, with his fiancée hands on hips in the shallows, looking impressively toned in her thong bikini, before a price was agreed, grudgingly on both parts, and the cash handed over without Casey having been consulted. As they left the comforting certainties of the beach behind, Casey experienced a vague sense of foreboding. Being on the water made him nauseous. Being in it awakened fears of what might lurk beneath. Yet it wasn't the thought of sharks or jellyfish or even drowning that was stoking his disquiet as the boat motored out to sea, but the suspicion he was moments away from being humiliated. The last time he'd tried, God, how he'd tried, to match his fiancée's fearless athleticism had been in Barbados at spring break the previous year. After half a dozen attempts to stand upright had all produced the same result, him face-planting at speed into the sea's unforgiving surface. He'd been forced to add water skiing to the long list of things that Tanya was better at than him.
A Taste for Murder by Matt Baker is narrated by Jason Dunn and runs for 12 hours, 46 minutes.
The Secrets of Dragonfly Lodge by Rachel Hoare was donated by Simon & Schuster.
What a difference a year can make. Late one Thursday afternoon, Steph Lansdowne was taking a shower and didn't see a sparrow alight on the sill of the open window of her studio flat and peck at some breadcrumbs she'd scattered there. It glanced about, its beady eyes alert. After a moment, it spread its wings and darted inside. The empty room lay bathed in sunshine, the roar of traffic from the street almost drowned out by a loping hip-hop beat shaking the floor. The bird didn't seem frightened. It circled, perched briefly on a bedside lamp, then flitted back to the sill, where it continued its meal. Steph's flat was situated on the first floor of a modern block in Balham, South London. Its single room, with galley kitchen and bathroom cubicle, was light and airy, but marred by clutter. An unmade double bed dominated the space. Washing was drying on a rack. Newspapers and spiral-bound notebooks lay tumbled across a tiny sofa, pushed up against a wall of bookshelves. On a coffee table under the window, a modest clutch of birthday cards shivered in the breeze. Among the books were piled a dozen copies of Secrets of an Author's Wife by Stephanie Lansdowne. An angle-poised lamp stood sentry on a narrow pine desk over an open laptop next to a mobile phone and a mug of cooling tea. A light blue jacket hung on the back of the chair. Suddenly, the room leapt into life. The rush of water cut out, loudening the throb of the music downstairs. The startled sparrow flew away. The shower room door swung open, and Steph stepped out through a billowing cloud of vapour, like a modern Venus wrapped in a white towel. A birthday card caught in the draft and sailed to the floor. She picked it up and frowned at its message. Life is short. Smile while you still have teeth. Happy birthday. Ha ha. As she returned it to the table, her phone began to ring. She sighed, then answered it.
Nancy Foster has harbored a devastating secret that shattered her professional and personal life. On meeting her, journalist Steph Lansdowne realizes that she has the power to restore Nancy's reputation and to heal the wounds, if only Nancy will trust her. But someone else wants to get to the bottom of the story first, someone who doesn't want it to be told. Set in the beautiful Norfolk Broads in 2010 and in London in the 1940s and 50s, when life for career-driven women was so different.
Steph had embraced turning 30. On her birthday, her lawyer boyfriend Sam had thrown a party for her at a trendy wine bar near their luxurious flat in Clapham. She had a promising career as a journalist on a national broadsheet newspaper and was about to publish her first book. Personal happiness and success seemed secure, and a bright future beckoned. By the time she was 31, that future had darkened. She and Sam had split up acrimoniously, and since it was his flat, she'd had to find somewhere else to live. Soon afterwards, her job went in a round of redundancies, and despite a small severance payment and the slightly larger advance she'd been given for her book, it was becoming a struggle to pay the bills. She'd picked herself up and was making a new life for herself, but she still felt battered and bruised. Mum, hi. Steph tucked the phone between shoulder and ear, gathered the towel more tightly in one hand, and continued drying herself with the other, while her mother rambled on about Steph's failure to call and the lack of rain for the garden. She listened with increasing impatience. Her mum had a habit of ringing on a whim and launching into a monologue without asking if it was convenient. She took advantage of a pause for breath to ask, "Was there anything urgent, Mum? Only I'm about to go out."
"You should have said, with anyone nice?"
Her mum's falsely casual tone could not disguise her real meaning. "Is there a young man involved?"
The Secrets of Dragonfly Lodge by Rachel Hoare, is narrated by Sophie Roberts, and runs for 11 hours and 54 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And now a return to my chat with Tia Fisher. Please note this part discusses sensitive subjects such as lack of consent and teenage pregnancy. The audio version of Not Going to Plan is read by Imogen Front and Charlie Bateman, sometimes at the same time.
Dunham doesn't do a prom, thank goodness.
The night before the exhibition, I lie awake for ages feeling bad about not being brave enough. And what about Jessica? Twisted up with jealousy, insecurity and need? The way she was shaded makes her Harry's victim too. I go into the bathroom and turn on the light. Who are you, Marnie Stadler? My reflection stares back at me. Straggly plaits snaking over my shoulders, snarled rivulets of indecision. Long hair Harry said he loved. Naomi said artists must be brave, but she had no idea just how brave I'm going to be. I pick up the nail scissors.
Marnie, it's the middle of the night.
Mum walks into the brightly lit bathroom just as I snip the last of my braids and it drops to join the tangle at my feet. Oh, Mum gasps. What have you done?
Now, you've dealt with drugs, you've dealt with pregnancy. How is it that you balance very adult themes in books aimed for young adults?
So, for both Crossing the Line and Not Going to Plan, and in fact for the new middle grade one coming out, which is called Operation Doodlebug, it's got to be humour. You've got to find humour within the characters and within the way that the characters mesh with each other. And this humour are like the little nuggets that keep you carried along. And you've got to mix the light with the shade, I think.
Well, I really laughed at the description of ice skating. I won't say it because I'll mess it up, but yeah. a very bad way of getting somewhere you don't really want to go.
Yeah, one of the ice skating people was actually based on my best friend who ice skates like a giraffe.
Now, what's your opinion of the use of the word stealthing? And do you think that word covers up what it actually is?
That's not a question I've been asked before. So stealthing, to listeners who don't know, and I didn't know when I started writing this book, is pretending to use a condom. Either a man or a woman, I guess, could do this and not doing so. Does it cover up what the word it actually is? Because it sounds a bit ninja, doesn't it? I guess it does, but if you're going to look it up, aren't you? You're going to think, why have they just said stealthing? What is stealthing? And when you realise you can interpret it, I mean, it's part of, generally speaking, it's part of the whole manosphere, toxic masculinity idea of disrespecting women. That's generally the circumstances in which somebody will not use a condom when they should do. I used the term in the book because I discovered that there was a term for it. And it became, like all these things, it became a useful shorthand. It is, as I say in the book, it is technically rape. You can be charged with rape because if you have sex with somebody without a condom and they think you're wearing one, and they are having sex without their consent. And that's got life-changing implications.
Talking of life-changing, Marnie has a choice to make in this book, quite a big one. But do you think it's a travesty that the UK is only one of a handful of countries in which he was able to make that choice?
Absolutely. And that is why I wrote the book. I have a family member who works, she set up a charity in Canada to help kids in Texas, not just kids, anybody in Texas, who's not able to access an abortion. And as you're probably aware, about a third of the states in the United States, you cannot access abortions. Some you can get for, you know, for really, really dire reasons, but it's becoming harder and harder. And this is going to be a creep over the world. And we need to call it out. We need to say no while we still can. I think this is so important. This is a very, very hard won right. People will end their pregnancies, whether it is legal or not. And the chief difference is that the might die if they do so in an unsafe way.
I put down the scissors and take a look at the new, clear-eyed, braver me staring back from the glass. Hair cropped short, no fringe, nothing to hide behind. A style that says, no shame here. But perhaps it is a bit more scruffy than I'd planned. Mum, I say, a little help here? Mum draws in a breath. I'll do what I can, she says, smiling, and picks up the shears. We talk while she tidies up the tufts, talk about the choices I can make now. It's gone 2 a.m. before we're finished. I go back to bed, and this time sleep takes me fast as shutdown.
Your last two novels have been verse novels, a writing style that you said suited you. What has prompted the move to prose for your new book, Operation Doodlebug?
I just wanted to challenge myself. I was doing this MA with an amazing bunch of workshoppers, and we got given this exercise, and it would have one character describe another without using, without describing them, just from the way they interplay. And so I wrote it, and I wrote these two boys on a bomb site, and I totally fell in love with them. Like, you know, most of my characters, they are very different from each other. And when it came to time to choose my thesis, I thought, let's do this. I know I can do verse. Let's try and do prose. And I know I can do teen, so let's try and do middle grade. And one of the characters is disabled. And I wanted this extra challenge of trying to write a disability, that the character has dwarfism. Wanting to write this disability in an authentic way in World War II, but in a way which will be acceptable and generate the right kind of conversation for today's young people. And it was a challenge. I got it sent, as we always should do, especially if we're writing beyond our own lived experience. It was sensitivity read by this wonderful woman called Dr. Erin Pritchard, who is herself a dwarf and works at the Hope University in Liverpool. And she's a kind of spokesperson for dwarfism in the media.
The two novels, Crossing the Line and Not Going to Plan, they're very visually striking. What is it you use to type them up into that shape?
I use Word.
No, Word is notorious for, you know, you put in a picture and the text jumps to the next street along.
It's a nightmare. I mean, it takes me so long. It takes me longer to format than it does to actually write the word. I teach workshops in schools where you go, it's all about text boxes, and you have to make your text boxes transparent, and you have to do all these. Then there are ways in Word that you can format the text to make it go into all these interesting shapes, and then just occasionally you can't do it, and you have to go outside and try and use some free tool that will let you then, you know, take a snapshot of it and bring it in another text box. I mean, it is lunatic. And trying to edit them, it's like, you know, it's like knitting that threatens to fall apart at any moment. So, yeah, it is bonkers, but it's also fun. I enjoy it. And I did, you know, like Marnie, I did art at school, and it's my chance to be visually creative at the same time.
So you really do like a challenge.
I do. And in fact, so for any listeners who do have any vision, if you look at the printed book, I did the chapter headers for Not Going to Plan. I did them myself because Marnie's an artist. And so I was experimenting with the kind of art that Marnie was doing. You know, I've got A-level art. She's doing GCSE art. I thought, yeah, I can do this. You know, they're not very good, but they are for Marnie.
Can you give us a wee description of one of the chapter headings and the cover of the book as well?
Okay, I'll start with the cover. Oh, I love this cover so much. Clever, clever, clever designers at Hotkey Books. So I didn't want to have a picture of Marnie and Zed. It was really important to me that the pictures that you generate in your heads when you read are just from the words that I use on the page. And I don't do very much description. So they can be who you want them to be, just with a few kind of key characteristics. So no picture of them. What you see is the colour. My favourite colours, Marnie's favourite colours, sunset colours of pink and scarlet and orange. And then because Marnie's journey in art is screen printing, they've screen printed the words "not going to plan" in this bold text. And the "not" is a kind of add-on. It's in a different script. So you think it says "going to plan" and then you read actually it's been corrected to "not going to plan." But when you look closer at the screen printing, you see it's slightly on the skew because so much of what Marnie does is a mistake. It is not going to plan. That's who she is. So we've reflected that. And it's got these gorgeous quotes. So Margaret MacDonald, who won last year's Carnegie, who is now a dear writing friend of mine, she's got a quote there. And so has, very importantly, Kelly McCochran, also from Carnegie fame, who wrote this brilliant book also about choices that you can make when you get pregnant, not intentionally. And right in the middle of the O of two, you've got two red lines, which are the positive lines on a pregnancy test. Oh, I was going to describe, wasn't I, one of the chapter headers. So you find out why Marnie did this at the end of the book. No spoilers, but Marnie's written the numbers. There are, I don't know, 30-something chapters. Marnie's written the numbers of the chapters in different ways and made them into screen prints. And so, like, number 19 that I'm reading at the moment is bits of screwed-up paper made into a 19. Chapter 25 is a postcard which she made him, which is put 25 reasons to forgive me. And they're all screen prints.
Are you a fan of Georgia O'Keeffe?
Totally. Marnie likes to shock. And so when we first meet her, when she's at her posh boarding school, she's doing this school project on Georgia O'Keeffe's flower series, which can be interpreted as vulvas. I personally see the vulvas in them. Georgia O'Keeffe always denied it, but you can see her tongue, you know, poking firmly out of her cheek when she did so. So basically, she's been screen printing. No, she's not screen printing. She's been drawing vulvas as her school project, which, of course, her posh boarding school thinks is completely awful and they don't want her to do that. So, yeah, that's Marnie for you.
Don't have to answer this one if you don't want to, but at the end, what were the results?
Oh, the GCSEs. It's a cliffhanger. I've had kids ask me this, what were their GCSEs? And I've had to sit so firmly on the fence. And I've said to them, what do you think? What would you like them to have been? And they tell me, and I usually say, you got it.
Good answer. Tell me about your friend who's visually impaired.
So this is, if you know Crossing the Line, you'll know that Crossing the Line was based on a real person, and the real person's dad, who dies in Crossing the Line, does not die, thank heavens, in real life. He's blind, and he's got a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which means he's only got a small field of vision, right in the centre of his vision. And I asked him before we did this interview about how he reads. I mean, he doesn't read Braille, because this came on very late for him in his life. He was in his 30s when this happened to him. And he reads normal books because if he expanded the screen, he wouldn't see anything at all. But for him, as for other people with limited sight, reading is the thing that he can do without assistance from anybody else. And, you know, travel is difficult for him, as it is for many visually impaired people. He has a guide dog, and reading means, you know, he can go anywhere in his head and pursue any of his interests. In his head, you know, we've got "go all in" as the motto for the year of reading. He can go all in to whatever his hobbies are through the medium of a book or an audiobook. So it's hugely important to him.
My class tutor smiles from the frame of her hijab. She waves me to the only empty seat right at the back. It's all about first impressions. I have to set the tone. Don't let them smell my fear.
Here goes. Hips forward, and I style it down the catwalk alley through the tables. Each upturned face has eyes on me like I'm some kind of monster, so I just glare right back.
The stranger has a nest of snaky plaits and a stare to set stone. She strides towards me, whispering rustles like leaves in her wake. I remove my headphones in alarm. "This is Marnie Stadler, Zed," says Ms. Rahman. "The new girl I said would be joining us. Please make her feel welcome." But the girl's arrival is news to me, although I might just possibly not have been listening.
Some scholarship girl I am. I should have been smart enough to realise there'd be kids here from my old primary. Psst! Even 5 years on, I'd know the smile of little Luca Moreno, sitting third row back, except he's not so little now. He winks a familiar dark eye at me and mouths, "Money?" I turn my head and, oh my God, there's Jessica Bates. Jessica Bates. Bad news. It probably was me who gave her head lice in year five, but the way she carried on, you'd think it was the plague. She proper knit-shamed me. Gave me full-on PTSD in return. By the time I reach the only vacant spot, my nose is so high in the air I nearly miss my seat. I plonk myself next to a boy with a white face and glasses. He looks horrified.
The new girl thuds into the seat beside me and slams her open bag down on what is actually my desk. The bag tips open and a tampon makes a cunning bid for freedom, but I intercept it before it's seen. Ms. Rahman claps hands for eyes front. I observe how Jessica Bates and the new girl side-eye each other right through registration.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Every weekday on RNIB Connect Radio, we bring you a classic RNIB talking book, serialised and played in full over time.
The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde.
The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
You'll hear much-loved novels and timeless favourites brought to life by some truly brilliant narrators who know how to let a story breathe.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnett.
Hello, I'm John Cormack.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagen.
Join us every weekday at 2 p.m. with a repeat at 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
I'm Michael Palin, and you're listening to Talking Books
only on RNIB Connect Radio. And finally, on today's show, a return to Tia Fisher for the Books of Our Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
This book made me fall in love with listening to books. So my mum and my dad were amazing, particularly my dad when he was home. He enjoyed doing this. He had a beautiful voice. And they used to read to us and bedtimes at any time. And the book that formed the biggest part of my childhood, probably. Oh, two books, actually. Winnie the Pooh and My Children Fell Asleep to the Stephen Fry version of that when they were little, and also Paddington. And these, both of those are books which work for grown-ups as well as children, and I love them. And that special bonding thing about being read to, it's so important.
"I haven't really got a name," he said, "only a Peruvian one which no one can understand." "Then we'd better give you an English one," said Mrs. Brown. "It'll make things much easier." She looked around the station for inspiration. "It ought to be something special," she said thoughtfully. As she spoke, an engine standing in one of the platforms gave a loud wail, and a train began to move. "I know what," she exclaimed. "We found you on Paddington Station, so we'll call you Paddington." Paddington. The bear repeated it several times to make sure. "It seems a very long name," Quite distinguished, said Mr. Brown. Yes, I like Paddington as a name. Paddington it shall be. Mrs. Brown stood up. Good. Now, Paddington, I have to meet our little daughter Judy off the train. She's coming home from school. I'm sure you must be thirsty after your long journey, so you go along to the buffet with Mr. Brown, and he'll buy you a nice cup of tea. Paddington licked his lips. I'm very thirsty, he said. Seawater makes you thirsty. He picked up his suitcase, pulled his hat down firmly over his head, and waved a paw politely in the direction of the buffet. After you, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Paddington, said Mr. Brown. Now, Henry, look after him, Mrs. Brown called after them, and for goodness sake, when you get a moment, take that label off his neck. It makes him look like a parcel. I'm sure he'll get put in a luggage van or something if a porter sees him. The buffet was crowded when they entered, but Mr. Brown managed to find a table for two in a corner. By standing on a chair, Paddington could just rest his paws comfortably on the glass top. He looked around with interest while Mr. Brown went to fetch the tea. The sight of everyone eating reminded him of how hungry he felt. There was a half-eaten bun on the table, but just as he reached out his paw, a waitress came up and swept it into a pan. "You don't want that, dearie," she said, giving him a friendly pat. "You don't know where it's been." Paddington felt so empty he didn't really mind where it had been, but he was too polite to say anything. "Well, Paddington," said Mr. Brown, as he placed two steaming cups of tea on the table and a plate piled high with cakes. "How's that to be going on with?" Paddington's eyes glistened.
That's Stephen Fry reading A Beer Called Paddington by Michael Bond, one of many Paddington books in the RNIB library. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
This is the book that I have loved since I first read it when I was about 9. It was in my aunt's house, and I went out and bought a copy for myself as a grown-up. This is my I've Got Flu book, and it's Flowers for Mrs. Harris by Paul Gallico, which I think was made into a film called Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. And it's just the most feel-good book. It's about this char lady, and a woman she cleans for has got this Dior dress, and she falls in love. This wrinkly old char lady falls in love with this dress, and she knows it's not for her, and she doesn't want to wear it. She just wants to have it. She covets it. And so she works and she works and she works and she works, and she saves up the money for this dress. And then she goes to Paris, and oh my goodness me, how are these haute couture snobs, French Parisian, Parisian snobs going to look at her? And most of them give her a really hard time, but a few of them are gems of people. And it's about how Mrs. Harris wins everybody over with the force of her Cockney personality. And it's a transformation story and a story about how good souls win out. And I love it.
The small, slender woman with apple-red cheeks, greying hair and shrewd, almost naughty little eyes sat with her face pressed against the cabin window of the BEA Viscount on the morning flight from London to Paris. As, with a rush and a roar, it lifted itself from the runway, her spirit soared aloft with it. She was nervous, but not at all frightened, for she was convinced that nothing could happen to her now. Hers was the bliss of one who knew that at last she was off upon the adventure, at the end of which lay her heart's desire. She was neatly dressed in a somewhat shabby brown twill coat and clean brown cotton gloves, and she carried a battered imitation leather brown handbag, which she hugged close to her. And well she might, for it contained not only 10 1-pound notes, the legal limit of currency that could be exported from the British Isles, and a return air ticket to Paris, but likewise the sum of $1,400 in American currency, a thick roll of $5, $10, and $20 bills held together by a rubber band. Only in the hat she wore did her ebullient nature manifest itself. It was of green straw, and to the front of it was attached the flexible stem of a huge and preposterous rose, which leant this way and that, seemingly following the hand of the pilot upon the wheel as the plane banked and circled for altitude. Any knowledgeable London housewife who had ever availed herself of the services of that unique breed of daily women who come in to scrub and tidy up by the hour, or for that matter, anyone English, would have said, "The woman under that hat could only be a London char." And what is more, they would have been right. On the Viscount's passenger list, she appeared as Mrs. Ada Harris, though she invariably pronounced it as Mrs. Harris. Number 5, Willis Gardens, Battersea, London, SW11. And she was indeed a charwoman, a widow who did for a clientele living in and on the fringes of fashionable Eaton Square and Belgravia. Up to that magic moment of finding herself hoisted off the face of the earth, her life had been one of never-ending drudgery, relieved by nothing more than an occasional visit to the Flicks, the pub on the corner, or an evening at the music hall. The world in which Mrs. Harris, now approaching the 60s, moved was one of perpetual mess, slop, and untidiness. Not once, but half a dozen times a day, she opened the doors of homes or flats with the keys entrusted to her, to face the litter of dirty dishes and greasy pans in the sink, acres of stale, rumpled, unmade beds, clothing scattered about, wet towels on the bathroom floor, water left in the tooth glass, dirty laundry to be packed up, and of course cigarette ends in the ashtrays, dust on tables and mirrors, and all the other litter that human pigs are capable of leaving behind them when they leave their homes in the morning.
Flowers for Mrs. Harris by Paul Gallico is available from RNIB under the name Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, and also includes Mrs. Harris Goes to New York. Both are narrated by Juliet Stevenson. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
I recommend it to everybody. It's from last year's Carnegie shortlist, Claire Furness, The Things We Leave Behind. I think you interviewed her. It's set in a dystopian near future where the far right have taken over England and civil unrest in London's like, up to the limits. It's awful. There's riots. And for Clem and her half-sister Billy, it's not safe anymore. Their parents have gone AWOL. They've got to get out. And they do this journey up to Scotland, which is under a different regime and is a safe place to go. So they are refugees in their own country, refugees when they arrive in Scotland. And is there something that Clem isn't saying? She's talking to the counsellor in the refugee centre. She's retelling her story. She's got this notepad that she's been writing things in as she goes. Is there something? And this book is so special because, one, it's politically so close to where we are now. It's a hair's breadth away, showing us where we might go. Terrifying, and we all should learn from it. And the other thing is that Claire has done a piece of structural magic with this book. I look at it as a perfect example of how she's done what she's done, because the twist is so huge that I think a lot of people do what I did. When I got to the end, I just started at the beginning and I read it again to see what I'd missed. It's brilliant.
"You're looking well today," Polly says encouragingly as I walk into her office. In my head, Misha snorts. "She's just being nice. You look like you have some olden day disease. Scurvy. Or rickets. Oh no, wait. Consumption. Actually, maybe all of them." Polly smiles and fetches me some water, but I don't drink it because my throat feels so tight I'm not sure I could. I focus on acting normal. My nails dig into my palms. "So," Polly says, "why don't you tell me a bit about your home?" This wasn't a question I'd been expecting. "How do you mean?" She smiles. I mean, just about your family, friends maybe. Whatever you want to share. What life was like before all this. If you'd like to. I wouldn't like to. But it's easier than talking about what came after. And once I start, I find it's hard to stop. I tell her how we were just pretty normal. Me, Dad, Claudia and Billy. Even though I know there's no such thing as normal, and some people would probably think we weren't normal at all. But what I mean is that we were just pretty boring. I tell her about how it had just been Dad and me for a few years, before Dad and Claudia got together. How they had this mutual friend who was a journalist like Dad, and who'd been at university with Claudia, and he set them up on a date. And Dad thought Claudia wouldn't be interested in him because she was some high-flying doctor and beautiful and idealistic, and he was, in his words, a cynical old political hack with terrible dress sense. But it turned out they had loads in common. They were both only children, had both lost their parents in their 20s, both liked the same terrible music, which meant Billy and I later had to listen to it on every car journey, blah blah. They'd tell the story of how they met a lot. It was kind of cute, but kind of nauseating.
The Things We Leave Behind by Claire Furness is available from RNIB in Braille and in audio as read by Imogen Wild. That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, every episode is available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.